4. The girl in the doorway said in a soft, hesitant voice, I'm Joan Trieste. Lord Runningclam said you just moved in here. Her eyes roved. She was looking past Chuck Rittersdorf at the apt. You don't have any of your things moved in yet, do you? Can I help? I can put up curtains and clean the shelves in the kitchen if you want. Chuck said, thanks, but I'm okay. It touched him that the slime mold had done this, rounded up this girl. She was, he decided, not even 20. She wore her hair in one large, massive braid down her back, and it was brown hair, without particular color, really just ordinary hair. And quite white, much too pale. And it seemed to him her neck was a trifle too long. She had no figure at all to speak of, although she was at least slender. Joan Trieste wore skin-tight dark pants and slippers and a cotton man-style shirt. As far as he could tell, she had on no bra, as fashion dictated, but her nipples were merely flat, dark circles beneath the white cotton fabric of her shirt. She could not afford or did not care to have the currently popular dilation operation. It came to him then that she was poor, possibly a student. Lord Runningclam, she explained, is from Ganymede. He lives across the hall. She smiled slightly. She had, he saw, very fine, small, even white teeth, quite regular, well-formed. Almost perfect, in fact. Yes, Chuck said. He flowed in here under the door an hour or so ago, he added. He said he was sending someone. Apparently, he thought, did you really try to kill yourself? After a pause, he shrugged. The slime mold thought so. You did. I can tell even now. I can see it about you. She walked past him and into the apt. I'm a sigh. What kind of sigh? He left the hall door open, went to get his pack of Pall Malls to light up. There's all kinds, from those who can move mountains to those who can only... Joan broke in. I have a very meager power, but look. Turning, she raised the lapel of her shirt. See my button? Bonafide member of Psymen Incorporated of America, she explained. What I can do is I can make time flow backward. In a limited area, say 12 by 9, about the size of your living room, up to a period of 5 minutes. She smiled, and once again he marveled at her teeth. They transformed her face, made it beautiful. As long as she smiled, she was delightful to behold. And it seemed to Chuck that this told something about her. The quality of beauty arose from within. Inside, she was lovely. And he realized that over the years as she aged, it would gradually work its way outward, influence the surface. By the time she was 30 or 35, she would be radiant. Right now, she was still a child. Is that a useful talent? He asked. It has a limited use. Perching on the arm of his archaic Danish-style sofa, she stuck her fingers in the pockets of her tight pants and explained, I work for the Ross Police Department. They rush me to bad traffic accidents and, you'll laugh, but it really works. I turn time back to before the accident, or if I'm too late, if more than 5 minutes has gone by. Sometimes instead, I can bring back a person who's just died. See? Perching on the arm of his archaic Danish-style sofa, she stuck her fingers in the pockets of her tight pants and explained, I work for the Ross Police Department. They rush me to bad traffic accidents and, you'll laugh, but it really works. I turn time back to before the accident, or if I'm too late, if more than 5 minutes has gone by. Sometimes instead, I can bring back a person who's just died. See?
I see, he said.
It doesn't pay much. And worse than that, I have to be on call 24 hours of the day. They notify me at my CONAPT, and I go by high-speed jet hopper to the spot, see? She turned her head, pointed to her right ear. He saw a small, stubby cylinder embedded in her ear and realized it was a police receiver. I'm always tuned in. That means I can't be more than a few seconds run from transportation, of course. I can go to restaurants and theaters and other people's houses, but...
Well... he said. Maybe you can save my life sometime. He thought, if I had jumped, you could have forced me back into existence again. What a great service. I've saved many lives. Joan held out her hand. May I have a cigarette too? He gave her one, lit it, feeling, as usual, guilty of his lapse. What do you do? Joan asked. With reluctance, not because it was classified, but because it held so low a status in the ladder of public esteem, he described his job with the CIA. Joan Trieste listened intently. Then you help keep our government from falling, she said with a smile of delight. How wonderful! Charmed, he said, thanks. But you do. Just think, right this moment, hundreds of simulacra all over the communist world are saying your words, halting people at street corners and in jungles. Her eyes shone. And all I can do is help the Ross Police Department.
There's a law, Chuck said, which I call Ritterdorf's Third Law of Diminished Returns, which states that proportional to how long you hold a job, you imagine that it has progressively less and less importance in the scheme of things. He smiled back at her. The glow in her eyes, the sparkle of white teeth, made smiling easy. He was beginning to forget his burdening, despairing mood of a short while ago. Joan roamed about the Connaught. Are you going to move a lot of personal things in, or are you going to live just like this?
I'll help decorate it for you, and Lord Runningclam will too, to the extent he can. And down the hall, there's a molten metal life form from Jupiter called Edgar. He's hibernating these days, but when he comes back to life, he'll want to pitch in. And in the app to your left, there's a whizbird from Mars. You know, with a multicolored headdress. It has no hands, but it can move objects by psychokinesis. It'll want to help, except that for today it's hatching. It's on an egg.
God, Chuck said. What a polygenetic building.
He was a little stunned to hear all this. And, Joan said, on the floor below you is a green sloth from Callisto. It's all wound around a three-way floor lamp that's standard equipment in these Connaughts, circa 1960. It'll wake up as soon as the sun sets. Then it goes out and shops for food. And you already met the slime mold.
She puffed vigorously and a trifle inexpertly on her cigarette.
I like this place. You meet all sorts of life forms. Before you, a Venusian moss inhabited this apt. I saved its life once. It had dried out. They've got to keep moist, you know. In the end, this climate here in Marin County was too dry for it. Finally, it moved north to Oregon, where it rains all the time. Turning, she halted and surveyed him. You look like you've had a lot of trouble.
No real trouble, just the imaginary kind, the avoidable kind.
He thought, trouble that if I had used my head, I never would have become involved with. I never would have married her.
What's your wife's name?
Startled, he said, Mary.
Don't kill yourself because you've left her, Joan said. In a few months or even weeks, you'll feel whole again. Now you feel like one half of an organism that's split apart. Binary fission always hurts. I know, because of a protoplasm that used to live here. It suffered every time it split, but it had to split. It had to grow.
I guess growth hurts.
Going to the picture window, he once more looked down at the footer runnels and the wheels and jet hoppers below. He had come so close.
This isn't a bad place to live, Joan said. I know. I've lived a lot of places. Of course, everybody in the Ross Police Department knows the discarded arms, she added candidly. There's been a lot of trouble here. Petty thefts, fights, even one homicide. It's not a clean place. You can see that.
And yet?
And yet, I believe you ought to stay. You'll have company. Especially at night, the non-T life forms that live here begin to circulate, as you'll find out. And Lord Runningclam is a very good friend to have made. He's helped a lot of people. Ganymedians possess what St. Paul calls caritas. And remember, Paul said caritas was the greatest of all the virtues. She added, the modern word for it would be empathy, I guess.
The Connaught door opened. Chuck turned instantly and saw two men whom he knew quite well. His boss, Jack Elwood, and his co-worker in scriptwriting, Pete Petrie. At the sight of him, both men looked relieved.
Darn it, Elwood said. We thought we were too late. We stopped by your house thinking you might be there.
Joan Trieste said, speaking to Elwood, I'm from the Ross Police Department. May I see your ID papers, please?
Her voice was cool. Elwood and Petrie showed her their CIA identification, briefly, then strolled over to Chuck.
"What's the city police doing here?" Elwood asked.
"A friend," Chuck said. Elwood shrugged. Obviously, he did not intend to press for details.
"Couldn't you have found a better apt for yourself?"
He surveyed the room.
"This place literally smells."
"It's only temporary," Chuck said uncomfortably. "Don't deteriorate," Pete Petrie said. "And your leave? They canceled it. They think you ought to be at work, for your own good. You shouldn't be alone where you can brood." He eyed Joan Trieste, clearly wondering if she had interfered with a suicide attempt. No one, however, enlightened him. "So, will you come back to the office with us? There's a hell of a lot to do. You'll be there all night, the way it looks." "Thanks," Chuck said. "But I've got to start moving my things. I need to decorate this app to some extent, anyhow." He still wanted to be alone, as much as he appreciated their intentions. It was an instinct to crawl away, to hide himself. It came from the blood. To the two CIA men, Joan Trieste said, "I can stay with him for a while at least, unless I get an emergency call. There's usually one at around 5 o'clock when the heavy commuter traffic starts, but until—"
"Listen," Chuck said brusquely.
The three of them turned questioningly toward him.
"If someone wants to kill himself," Chuck said, "you can't stop him. Maybe you can delay it. Maybe a psi like Joan here can drag him back. But even if he's delayed, he'll do it. And even if he's brought back, he'll find a way to do it again. So leave me alone."
I felt tired. "I've got a 4 o'clock appointment with my attorney. I got many things to do. I can't stand around talking."
Looking at his watch, Elwood said,
"I'll drive you to your lawyer's. We can just make it."
He curtly motioned to Petrie. To Joan, Chuck said, "Maybe I'll see you again, sometime." He felt too weary to care one way or another.
"Thanks,"
he said vaguely. He did not know precisely what he was thanking her for. With careful emphasis, Joan said, "Lord Runningclam is in his room, and he can pick up your thoughts. If you try to kill yourself again, he'll hear and interfere. So if you intend to do it—"
"Okay," Chuck said. "I won't try it here."
He went to the door with Elwood and Petrie, one of them on each side of him. Joan followed. As they passed out into the corridor, he saw that the slime mold's door was open. The huge yellow mound undulated slightly in greeting.
"Thank you, too," Chuck said, half ironically, and then passed on with his two co-workers from the CIA.
As they drove by wheel to Nat Wilder's office in San Francisco, Jack Elwood said,
"This is Operation 50 Minutes. We've asked to be allowed to include a man in the initial landing party, a routine request which, of course, has been honored."
He glanced thoughtfully at Chuck.
"I think we'll use a simulacrum in this case."
Chuck Rittersdorf nodded vacantly. It was standard procedure to use a simulacrum in projects involving potentially hostile factions. The CIA had a low operating budget and did not like to lose its men.
"In fact," Elwood said, "this simulacrum, it was made for us by GD down in Palo Alto, is finished and at our office, if you'd care to view it."
He examined a small notepad which he brought from his coat pocket.
"His name is Daniel Magaboom. 26 years old, Anglo-Saxon, graduated from Stanford with a master's in poli-sci. Taught for 1 year at San Jose State, then joined the CIA. That's what we'll tell the others in the project. Only ourselves will know it's a sim gathering data for us."
He concluded,
"As yet, we have not decided who to put in as determining guide for Dan Magaboom. Maybe Johnstone."
"That fool?" Chuck said.
A sim could operate autonomously to some extent, but in an operation of this type, too many decisions were required. Left to itself, Dan Magaboom would quickly reveal itself as a construct. It would walk and talk, but when time arrived for it to decide policy, then a good operator, seated in complete safety in level one of the CIA building in San Francisco, took control. As they parked the wheel on the roof field of Nat Wilder's office building, Elwood said reflectively,
"I was thinking, Chuck, that you might like to handle Danny."
Johnstone, as you say, isn't the best. Chuck glanced at him, taken by surprise.
Why? It's not my job.
The CIA had a corps of men trained for simulacra animation.
As a favor to you,
Elwood said slowly, gazing off into the heavy afternoon airborne traffic that hung like a layer of smoke over the city.
So you could be with your wife, so to speak.
After a time, Chuck said,
absolutely no.
Watch her, then.
What for?
He felt baffled anger and outrage.
Let's be realistic, Elwood said. It's obvious to CIA psych men that you're still in love with her, and we need a full-time operator for Dan Magaboom. Petri can do your scripts for a few weeks. Take this on, see how you like it. If you don't, then drop it and go back to your scripts. Lord, you've programmed simulacra for years. You ought to be a natural at remote. I'd make book on it. And you'd be going on the same ship with Mary, landing on Alpha 3M2 at the same time.
No, Chuck repeated.
He opened the door of the wheel, stepped out on the surface of the field. I'll see you later. Thanks for the ride.
You know, Elwood said, I could order you to take this remote. I would if I thought it would be in your interest, which it might well be. Here's what I think I'll do. I'll get out your wife's folder from the FBI and go over it. Depending on the kind of person she is, he gestured, I'll decide on that basis.
What kind of person should she be, Chuck said, for me to spy on her out of a CIA simulacrum?
Elwood said, a woman worth your going back to?
He shut the door of the wheel. Petri started up the motor, and the wheel shot up into the late afternoon sky. Chuck stood watching it go.
CIA thinking, he said to himself caustically. Well, I ought to be used to it by now.
But Elwood was right about one thing. He had indeed programmed many simulacra, and with calculatedly persuasive rhetoric. If he took over the remote, he could not only successfully manage Dan Magaboom, or whatever it was called, he could, and this did make him pause, he could transform the simulacrum into a delicately tuned instrument, a machine that guided, beguiled, and, yes, even corrupted those around him. He himself could not be that articulate. Only in his craft was he masterful. Dan Magaboom, in Chuck's hands, could accomplish a great deal vis-a-vis Mary Rittersdorf, and no one knew that better than his boss, Jack Elwood. No wonder Elwood had suggested it. But it had a potentially sinister quality. It repelled him. He shrank back from it, intuiting its odiousness. And yet, he could not simply turn it down out of hand. Things, life itself, existence on Earth, were not that candid. The solution, perhaps, lay in having someone he could rely on do the remote. Petri, for instance. Someone who could watch out for his interests. And then he thought, just what are my interests? Reflexively, he descended by in-ramp, deep in thought, because a new idea, not one suggested by his boss, Jack Elwood, had slipped without notice into his mind. He thought, there is one thing that might be accomplished under such circumstances. A CIA simulacrum with Mary on a distant moon in another star system entirely, among the psychotic members of a deranged society. Something which might pass, given such exceptional circumstances. It was not an idea which he could discuss with anyone. In fact, he found it difficult to express it even to himself. However, it had its advantages over suicide, and he had almost achieved that. Under such circumstances, I could actually manage to kill her, he said to himself. Through the CIA construct, or rather General Dynamics construct. Legally, I'd stand a reasonable chance of acquittal, since a simulacrum operated at that distance often functions on its own. Its autonomic circuits often take precedence over the long-range instructions from the remote. Anyhow, it's worth a try. In court, I'll plead that the simulacrum acted on its own, and I can sequester countless technical papers proving that simulacra often do such things. The history of CIA's operations is full of such bunglings at crucial points. And it will be the burden of the prosecution to prove that I gave the instructions to the simulacrum. He came to Nat Wilder's door,
It opened, and he passed on in, still deep in thought. It might or might not be a good idea. Certainly its merits were open to debate, on moral grounds alone, if not on merely practical grounds. But in any case, it was the sort of idea that once entertained did not tend to go away, like an idée fixe. It had entered his mind, and once there, it stayed, could not be reversed. It was not by any means even theoretically a perfect crime. Great suspicion would at once fall on him, the county or state prosecutor, whoever it was who handled such matters as this, would accurately guess very quickly what had transpired. So would the homeopathe reporters, among whom were some of the shrewdest minds in the U.S. But suspecting it and proving it were totally different matters. And to some extent, he could conceal himself behind the top-secret curtain which continually obscured the activities of the CIA. Between Terra and the Alphane system, it was over 3 light-years, an immense distance, certainly far too great a distance under ordinary circumstances over which to commit a capital crime. Many a slip of the electromagnetic signal as it passed into and out of hyperspace could in any case reasonably be assumed to exist as a constant factor. A defense attorney, if he were any good, could make a damn good case on that point alone. And Nat Wilder was such an attorney.